Тест. So the technology works today, perfect. Welcome to the second lecture. Welcome to the lecture two. We're going to talk today about digital forensics, different types of perspective when it comes to forensic science in general, when it comes to stages in digital forensics, the history. We'll also touch briefly the difference between crime investigation when it's a criminal case and incident response, because there is a substantial difference when it comes to how we handle the crime and how we handle the incident in the company. And they might be evaluated, there might be some affiliated challenges. And then I will talk also about the Budapest Crime Convention, Cybercrime Convention, when it comes to cybercrime. What's that? What are the challenges that exist in such convention? And in overall, what's the problem with cross-jurisdiction? So I hope you already found this book, at least online or in the library. It's a very nice book, and we are following closely each chapter in this book. So it's the introduction to digital forensics, and next week it will be the digital forensics process itself. So I strongly recommend you to check the chapters that are written in this table. We need volunteers for the reference group, so please reach out. I don't think I've seen any emails with the volunteering or anybody who volunteered. So please send me an email, and we'll put you in the reference group. So there will be a few meetings, like introductory meeting, the final meeting, and also you can ask Hildebakke about certificate of participation in the reference group. So this is something that you can put on your CV. It should not take more than a few hours during the semester. It's part of the quality assurance program. You'll need to write a short report in the end saying like what kind of things you learn during the course in terms of learning outcomes, like the skills, competence, what can be improved, what worked, what didn't work, and so on. If it's something related to the content, you can of course send an email to me or later Jeff during the lab session. But the report, the point of this report is a little bit different, is to evaluate the course content with respect to learning outcomes. So please send me emails. Right, so I'll talk about the forensic science, the criminal investigation, what is the digital evidence, what kind of evidence we may accept, and what kind of changes the evidence might face, or the digital evidence when we are processing the data from the computer, and when we need to have, for example, the proper timeline of the evidence, because there are a lot of challenges with the timeline in the sense that, well, this computer is Oslo time. If you bring another computer, for example, it can be New York time, right? But they happen to be in the same room, and then we think that, well, they probably have Oslo time. But for this, we need to check the system. So we need to check the configuration of the system. We need to check, some additional indicators that it's indeed this particular time frame, because it can be like 12 hours here, and it can be midday 12 o'clock, and it can be, for example, six o'clock in the morning in New York. So that's the difference between let's say how we perceive the timeline. Another challenge, I think I forgot to mention it during the IoT lecture today, is that Arduino does not have built-in time management. So it does not have the controller that keeps the time, so the timekeeping device or the controller, or it's a chip. So technically, you know, everything that is stored in Arduino or on the microSD card that connected to Arduino, we cannot really validate what's the timestamp. It's not the same for Raspberry Pi because normally it's a timekeeping agent that communicates. You know, it can be SNMP, NP, NTP, and so on. So like whatever protocol you can use for synchronization and keeping the time up to date. So that's the main thing that you need to remember. That Arduino does not have the time management, and that's why, you know, all evidences or all the data that we extract from anything connected to Arduino is questionable. I have the Mentimeter here. Let me open this one, and I'd like you to scan the code, also those who attend online. So this is needed for the lab week, because we need to see what kind of, you know, technical things, systems you have on your computer, what kind of, you know, skills and so on. Let's see, 13 people. So wait a few more minutes. All right, I guess we can start. So the first question is, what is your understanding of digital forensics? So I know that some of you might have courses related to incident response or digital forensics, you know, sometime in your bachelor study. Reverse engineering, Wireshark, perfect. So reverse engineering is the course that I believe happens next semester. So it's Gerald of Dirkelbotten that gives this course. Wireshark, it's a fantastic, very, very popular tool. Police, yes, cybercrime, evidence, crime, forensics, traces, yes. So the traces, or the, let's say, the digital data is technically a traces of some activity on the computer. Chain of custody, perfect. So chain of custody, we'll talk today also about chain of custody, OSINT. It's one of the novel areas when it comes to crime investigation, when it comes to collection of the data. Investigation. Timeline, perfect. So during the lab week, you will learn about timelining, how to use, you know, analysis, and how to put things together. Because as I mentioned, what if we have two laptops from different time zones, but we don't know this? So it means that our assumption about events on each of the laptop will be erroneous. So we cannot really say that, you know, it happened at the same time. Waiting for scripts. So scripting is good. It's a lot about scripting. Logs, yes, Kali Linux. So Kali Linux is a fantastic tool that I mentioned before also. And if you want to play a little bit, you know, with the analysis of the tasks of the different data, I strongly recommend to get the Kali Linux on your computer. Law enforcement, in a few weeks, time, actually it will be, I think, in October, we'll have two lectures from the police investigator from Kripos. So Jens Petter Sandvik, he's going to talk about embedded devices, he's going to talk about mobile forensics, internet forensics, you know, what kind of things you can extract. So it will be pretty exciting. Malware analysis, incident response, yes. So this one is very good. had some years when I get the responses on the right. So it's one of the books, but also I will upload today, for example, the recent publication on how to perform the digital forensics. So we still have one read, okay. And then you can read additionally, because you know the digital forensics is the area that you know is heavily developed, and new technologies like IoT, mobile things. You know, it's been so many things that changed a lot. Like one of the problems with cybercrime convention is that it's been developed in 2001, which is already 21 years old. And the problem that, you know, they put it or they framed it when they had the access to different type of technologies, like 20 years ago, you know, it's been still mobile phones with the buttons. There was quite limited Wi-Fi, we can say, sometimes dial-up connection, 56K. So three people think that it's red and 25 think it's black blue. So it's, I think it's a good result this year, and I'm really happy that you found the book. So please check the book. As I mentioned, during the lab week, there will be 3 days. So now it's scheduled for Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 4 hours each day. And it's the week, if I'm not mistaken, 40. So during that week, you will have a lot of hands-on. So it means that, you know, you can dedicate this time. It's from 4 to 8 p.m. Sit in the class, you know, learn things from Jeff, talk to Jeff, ask about, you know, things that you wonder. He has a lot of experience, as I mentioned before. It's also possible to attend this lab week online. So it will be streamed. You'll have access to the materials and you can sit at home and practice as well. But, you know, for the educational purposes, we recommend you to come to campus and, of course, practice it. All right, Python. So Python is a good language for scripting when you need to do some analytics, data analytics, you know, like processing. So it's a very good language, interpretable. C++, you will need to have some knowledge of C and C++ if you're going to do the reverse engineering, computer viruses. It's all, you know, assembly. Then you need to understand how, you know, the program works, how the binary program is being compiled. Bash, of course, it's the main script in Linux, main scripting language in Linux. Everything that you can do and automate in Linux, you probably will do it in Bash or SH. Linux, well, Kali Linux, it's a common, let's say, distro that is used for, you know, forensics or rather pen test and ethical hacking. And Google search helps a lot sometimes. It's a really powerful tool, so I recommend to master it as well. If you have some challenges with Linux especially and you don't know how to solve. Right, what kind of operating system you normally use? So Windows, mostly Windows. Just like to name a challenge that exists with macOS, and the particularly Apple M1, so those new processors that they have since 2020. The problem that this is ARM-based architecture and instruction set, which means that if you want to use VirtualBox or parallels with Windows or Linux on top of the macOS, then you won't be able because it's an ARM architecture. So that's the problem. You'll need to find, you know, maybe Windows or Linux that works for ARM. So just be aware that there might be some challenges when you want to install, you know, some of the things on your PC. Android, iOS, so the tablets and phones, they don't really work here when it comes to practical things. You can watch videos, but you need to have preferably a Linux or Windows machine. So as far as I know, there is no solution currently to this Mac issue with Apple M1 processor. So I just need to see if there will be some kind of solution soon. Because VirtualBox, I think they stated that they didn't plan to release any kind of support yet. Your expectation from the course? Introduction to digital forensics, analysis of malware, Cellebrite license, introduction to forensics. Yes, so there are a lot of tools that normally you can use for free. There are a lot of scripts that you can find for analysis of the data, for timelining, things like autopsy you can get. Cellebrite, IDAPRO, they need licenses. So of course, there are some possibilities to try it. Learn something new and have fun, yes, we will try to do it. Become digital Sherlock Holmes. Introduction to crime investigation, gain a basic understanding. Not too high after reading chapter one. No jail time, it's a good point. In a sense that, when you use things like Kali Linux, there will be things related to pen testing and ethical hacking. So please don't try anything inside the school network because we have a security operations center. Hopefully they will actually give us a guest lecture in their work. But please don't try anything related to pen testing inside the school. Search of open source, yes. Yes, how to search devices and see what has been done, happened. Yes, thank you for your answers. I'll share with Jeff so that he has an overview as well of things. Yes. So I'm going to close Mentimeter. Thank you for your answers. Now we have at least the picture of things that you're using and your expectations. Let's see. So list of papers, I've seen that many of you already formed the group, hopefully local experience-based remote. What you need to do is to select, as I mentioned, the papers, what kind of paper you want to read and present later, and then the projects. Any questions in the room so far? So it's very important that you select the paper, send me, what kind of paper, like number, P1, P3, and then the project also, the topic of the project, so that we can register and that you can start, reading, because the time flies very fast. Now it's still August, then it's November and end of the course. So the group work, normally 5 students. I know that some of the students are still joining, so maybe we have some students that join today, maybe we'll have some students that will join tomorrow, but please try to find a group or talk to me if you cannot find the group. So we have recommendation of 5 students, it's a limit, but due to some reasons you might have 4 or 6, it's also technically acceptable. You will need to present the paper and the project at a later point. I will open the folder, so you will need to read the paper and prepare like up to 10 minutes presentation of what you learned in this paper, because it's quite big papers on different technologies. But you also require to read other papers, because you might get some questions related to digital forensics and things that you'll find in these papers. The digital forensics process, details and deliverable information will come later, but as I mentioned, you need to select an area. There are 9 areas that you select. You send me the topic that you selected. And then using these topic, you need to create, or you need to think of the focus that you want to have in your project. So if it's a mobile forensics, then you know, you can write about Android, you can write about Mac devices, and so on. And this will be graded, so it's very important that you work on this during semester and that you deliver it to Inspera later in this course. So it will be probably end of November. I'll still need to talk to exam office. And then you will do the presentation of your project. So you need to deliver first the report, and then you need to deliver the project presentation. This is the timeline that we have now. So the topic selection of both papers and the project is 6th of September, so it's next week. Then you'll need to write a short abstract, like what kind of things you want to do, what is the problem area, what are the methods that you want to do, and what you're trying to solve. So whether it's a theoretical project or it's a practical kind of project with some theory. So you cannot just, you know, run experiments and say that this is my project. No, you need to have some kind of focus, like, again, about mobile forensics, you know, Android, for example, new Android malware, and so on. And please forward your selection to me. So group L1 selected the paper P1 and the topic P1 or something, because I have this overview, and then I will also give this overview to our to my colleague. He will be who is grading the projects, and he will also contact you about project presentation. Is Guo Chang Klim. Any questions so far? All right. So I hope all of you understood, because I got really a lot of questions. So just like to repeat things about the projects and group. So we try to have, you know, local. We have we try to have remote and experience-based students in different cohorts, because we have a different not just lifestyle, but the possibility to be on campus. If you're on campus, this is local group. So you can work, you can sit together during Wednesday sessions, and you have a dedicated room where you can spend time working. So I hope you got the point, and that you will start reading soon, or at least this week, and you have selected the topics for the papers and the projects. So I'm going to follow up one more time next week. So if I see that some of the groups didn't finish this task, you will get an email from me. Now, forensics. Forensics is something that has been in the movies a lot. And you've seen probably, you know, CSI and all other movies that kind of describe the work of the forensics in general, you know, when the police comes to the crime scene, but also more on the digital side, you know, cyber crimes, incident response, and the digital forensics. So forensic science, it's not a new thing like a digital forensics, but it's something that's been here or there for a while, and there are lots of different domains that you probably again seen in the movies, like forensics odontology, crime scene investigation, forensics biology, like DNA analysis, chemistry, pathology, and toxicology. So it's a lot of areas where the chemistry applied, and, you know, like how to analyze the substances, how to analyze the materials, how to make the conclusion, you know, how old is the material, how old is the you know, strain from this substance, and so on. When it comes to digital forensics, well, it's a lot of about decision tree, if yes, because, you know, the technology evolved, the technology are complex. Like in this case, if you want to analyze the Android device, you know, we need to check first if the device is on, you know, or not. If it's yes, you know, can we access the system? No, then don't turn it off. Just keep charged, plug the, you know, the charger. If it's off, you know, like you have a different set of instruction. But in the end, you know, we need to collect all possible information from the device. So no matter whether it's off or on, it's just the set of procedures that we will be using will be, of course, different. So the forensics in general is a set of scientific methodologies. And there are a lot of standards, there are a lot of processes, best practices, but the goal itself of the forensics is to help to establish the answers to certain questions, like what happened, who did it, where, how, why, and when. The idea here is to assist the law enforcement and national security agencies, and also enable the enterprise IT security and recovery. So we'll talk about the incident response and the crime investigation later in this lecture. There are a lot of methods, like in biology, you know, bugs, seeds, plants, time of days of this, location of the crime, identification of the victims. Medicine, again, it's all related to our body, identification of the victims, cause of this. Physics, you know, material sciences, like how fast the car traveled, you know, like what's the age of this, for example, scratch on the car, if it's old, if it's new. So it's a lot about analysis of the things when it comes to the general forensic science. You know, the composition of explosive, what kind of poisons used, the geology, location, for example, where the sand is coming from, you know, on the shoes, because then it can help to locate the particular area that the perpetrator or the victim came from. Mathematics, the statistics is one of the fundamental parts of the forensics, because it's a lot about the chances or likelihood of getting, like, for example, DNA analysis, you know, what's the chance of matching the random person in a particular country or in a particular state when you know, you have the evidences in some hard format. There was a very interesting case in Europe. It's called Phantom of Heilbronn. So it's 1993 to 2009, and there have been burglaries and murders, about 40 crimes since. And then after analysis of the evidences using the quantum swabs, they were finding, you know, traces of people. So they actually created a photo impression of the person who could be the potential serial perpetrator, and then there have been, you know, like these mysterious crimes happening all over the place. But then in the end, they found that actually the cotton swabs that they were using were contaminated, because the factory that produced those swabs, they didn't use any protective materials like gloves, for example. So it means that those swabs contained the biological material from people who worked at the factories from those countries. And that's why they kind of were creating the photo impression of people who are usually from those countries. So that was a very interesting case. Of course, this course will focus more on the computer forensics, on the, you know, file system, how to analyze RAM, how to analyze network traffic, but the history of the forensics itself spans over a few centuries. You can read, of course, about this in the book. There have been, for example, Matteo Orfila. It's considered the father of the forensics toxicology. You know, how to analyze the particular, like, chemical properties. Alphonse Bertillon developed a method for identification through body measurement, so like ID. You know, in our time, modern time, we have a legal, let's say, a description of personal identification bind by law, like what considered to be primary personal identifiable information, for example, what considered to be like direct or indirect, what considered to be special, you know, things that identify the person. And of course, at that time, it was the beginning, you know, they were trying to find the ways how to, you know, identify the person by certain metrics. Francis Gerton studied fingerprints. So, as you know, the fingerprints is one of the fingerprint analysis is one of the fundamental methods in the forensic science. We all leave fingerprints, and by fingerprints we can identify you know, like what, who was in the room, or like what happened, for example, and so on. And also fingerprints that are used in the technology, like on the phones, in the computer. So technically everything is connected to fingerprints. Now, Hans Gross is working on the applications of the investigation. So like what's the investigation, how to perform the investigation, and the timeline of investigation, you know, reporting, and so on. Albert Osborne, so he established the principle for the document examination. So there was a publication question document where, let's say, there was a foundation for how we analyze the documents. Like, if you have a printed, I don't know, A4 paper with some text, you know, I think it's just a text. However, it can give a lot information about who wrote this text. So it can be possible clues to the person who wrote. There can be some kind of habits that the person is using when writing, you know, maybe overusing commas or don't using commas at all. There can be, for example, some kind of identification of the, let's say, mother tongue. So if you can see the mistakes that the person is making or typos, you can have this attribution. So in overall, it's a treasure. It's just the way how we use the methodology, you know, it can reveal many, many things. Of course, now if we are having, you know, a Microsoft Office file on your computer, we can see like who edited, maybe a track change was on, and so on. Lionel Lattes studied the characteristics of the blood, so different blood types, or at that time there wasn't, let's say, capabilities to analyze DNA, but at least the way to reduce the number of suspects was through blood type identification. So it was quite useful. Edmund Lockhart, so it's a very famous person who suggested a thing that we also will be using in this course. It's Lockhart exchange principle. So it means that if there was a contact between objects, there will be traces from one object on another one, and vice versa. So it's definitely applicable in real life, in the physical life of forensic sciences, and it's been originally used for forensic sciences. In digital forensics, something that is attributed to the Lockhart exchange principle is, for example, when we go to a website. Visit website, it means that, first of all, there will be traces in the log files on the server. There will be traces in the log files in ISP, the provider side, and there will be traces on your computer in the Firefox or Chrome, saying that you access this website, right? So it's kind of Lockhart exchange principle, even though you know, it was originally designed for the physical world. It's applicable in digital forensics as well. And of course, you know, there are so many sources of information, and nowadays with all the technology around us, cameras, sensors, it's almost virtually impossible to have, you know, no contact. So anyway, you know, when you go to school, sorry, to the university, you open the door, it's one point of exchange that will be registered in the log file. You come to this room, you have your phones enabled, there will be a Wi-Fi MAC address registered in the system, plus your phone, which can be triangulated, you know, where you're located. You go to canteen, you buy some food, you know, there will be your card. If you use the card, there will be registration in the system that you use. So technically, you know, there is a huge cloud of information around you when you go to school, to the university or to other premises. I'm not talking about, you know, just purely digital world when you're visiting websites, you're visiting, you know, news websites, all these exchange, you know, cookies, they use for the marketing purposes, you know, and so on. So it's a huge amount of information that you don't even know about. So the criminal investigation process is usually focused on the things like, you know, what kind of means were used, what is the motive, and what kind of opportunity were there. Because sometimes you will see that if there is an opportunity, the crime will be committed. So it depends on many factors. Who did it? Like, who is the person that created the crime? Because it's one thing if the person did it, another thing if it happened just because it happened, like act of God, or I don't know. It's just, you know, you can figure out any type of explanation, like why it happened. It can be just pure coincidence. It can be a sabotage. It can be a deliberate action. So all possible hypotheses, you know, you can put at this stage. But there is a need to provide legally acquired evidence to prove that, you know, it's a guilt of a specific person. And this proof needs to be beyond a reasonable doubt. So it means that, you know, it needs to be a certainty that, you know, this person did it. You cannot say, well, it's 50% chance that this one did it and we need to send him to jail. It doesn't work like this. It needs to be a very concrete and substantial work. So the normal crime investigation includes analysis of the person of you know, who might be relevant to the investigation, person of interest, possible suspects, witnesses, and victims. So it's all a legally binding definition of people attributed to the crime scene. Can be also a missing person, and the missing person can become, let's say, a murder investigation. If, for example, a person been murdered, there can be all possible, you know, challenges, like what if the person moved to another state after the investigation started? What if the person is not cooperative and in other country? So what happened exactly? It's very important to have the view, like what exactly happened in, I don't know, in that particular room when the crime was committed. And it's not just, you know, for example, the direct evidences that you can see, obviously, okay, this is the I don't know, chair broken, right? But you may find also all type of information around it, like from the camera, from the noise sensors, you know, there was some kind of noise, and all type of data around it. So where the location, of course, it's quite important and depends on alibi. So the person may say that I wasn't here, I was on the moon, right? And I have some evidences that I was on the moon. I have selfie. So of course, the facts need to be checked, and also it needs to be established all type of, you know, things that related to the fact, like where the person was at the time, particularly when the crime happened, like before and after. And of course, jurisdiction plays an important role. Like if you want to access some kind of servers of a company, and the company is in the third country, and the police in our country does not have the jurisdiction to, you know, to get data of the person from that country. So it becomes very problematic. Luckily, there are a lot of agreements like Interpol, Europol, that help to improve the cooperation between the law enforcement agencies. How the crime committed? Who did it? What was the motive of committing? Maybe it's a serial killer. Maybe it was, you know, a contract killing ordered on the dark web, so dark net. So it means that, you know, it's a very kind of big area of how it happened. It might be that, you know, it's just a, I don't know, if it was a cyber attack, it might be that we have a case where a system administrator put a wrong configuration in the file, right? So it's just nothing criminal, just an incident. So we know how it happened. we fix it, and we monitor that it does not happen again. So it means that there is no criminal investigation in this. So when is the, let's say, the fundamental thing that you will also learn in the lab exercises? As I mentioned about Arduinos, in some cases you cannot really get the exact, you know, time frame that the file was created. Like in some of the devices, not just Arduino, but if you take some of the drones, if you take some of the cameras that take pictures and they have microSD card, and you open this microSD card, you'll find pictures, of course, and then the timestamp, which will be like 000 or 1990 or, you know, 2000. So it's just arbitrary timestamp that is assigned to every picture. But using the timeline, we also will be able to, you know, to identify the alibis. If people have alibis, they might be excluded from the crime investigation because they haven't been there and they don't have a kind of direct relation. So the timestamps important, but first thing we need to consider is the time zone, like which time zone the computer comes from, right? So if it's the laptop, you know, we cannot really validate what's the time zone that was used on the laptop, unless we open, you know, the configuration of the system, unless we check, you know, that indeed on the laptop it says 5 a.m. that the user accessed the website, but on the server it says that it's 10 a.m. So probably there was some difference in the time zones. Bad synchronization, so there might be a case when the difference between the clock that you have on the laptop will be a few seconds delayed or ahead of the time that you get, you know, from the time synchronization server. But it's not just that, but also that BIOS and Windows might have different timestamps just because, you know, the user didn't synchronize properly or there was some issue in the configuration. So, and then why? So what's the motivation? They can be, for example, if it's a cyber attack, they can be, you know, regular things to consider. If it's a script kiddie, people just played, there was no motivation, just, you know, to play Explorer tools. Please don't do it with the Kali Linux and pen testing here in campus. It can be politically motivating, so something where, you know, the one country is trying to attack another country. And it can be, for example, money. So the cyber attack happened because people wanted to get access to the information, maybe to credit card details, and use them to get some money to get rich. So we need to find the intent. What was the intent of the crime? So usually scientific method or the whole, let's say, forensics approach is to analyze the data, whatever data we have. If it's a digital forensics, of course we have the digital data. And then hypothesis testing. As I mentioned, we can create all possible hypotheses based on the evidences and then try to confirm the data or refute the data. So, you know, something that we can say that it's not relevant or it does not confirm the hypothesis or it confirms the hypothesis indeed it happened. Falsifiability. So if it's if it can be falsified, then it's not a science, you know. So it's a lot. You probably attended the course called, you know, research methodology, research ethics, methodology, scientific methodologies. You know, in different universities, it's different courses. But the idea that in scientific methods we have a hypothesis. So it's usually a null hypothesis, and it's some kind of hypothesis that we validate, and then we need to perform the testing. So we do the testing and we either reject or we accept the hypothesis. So hypothesis testing can be done from two sides, like presumption of innocence. So the null hypothesis will be innocent. Like we need to look whether, you know, we have enough evidence to reject the null hypothesis. And then presumption of guilt, whether we have enough evidences, you know, to reject the null hypothesis again, but just from the different side. For example, a controversial politician is accused of abusing the children. So we need to prove whether he's guilty or he's not guilty. I mentioned the proof beyond reasonable doubt, and if you look, we look at the whole kind of, you know, range of definitions when it comes to, you know, whether the event is probable or not probable, we have at the bottom impossible, so like the event couldn't possibly happen. Then we have maybe, so maybe yes, maybe no. Probably it means that, well, most likely it happened, but we don't have 100% certainty. And then we have a level where it's proved beyond a reasonable doubt, so we have the evidence that kind of confirms this hypothesis. And of course, the absolute certainty when, you know, we have full understanding, and maybe we've been, you know, at the time when the crime happened, we have all the evidences and witnesses in place. A hypothetical example. So let's assume we have a request from Metropolitan Police in UK to the Oslo Police Department with the following IP address. And then the request contains, let's say, the information that there is an abuse of children. So actually, it's an example from the master thesis of Nina Sunde, who works at the police in Oslo now. I can read a little bit more about, let's say, this example and the hypothesis. But technically, the request is to identify the subscriber of the IP, like who is the person. So we need to link a person who is in UK and who might be sitting beyond the IP address at that particular time. Obtain a search warrant, search and arrest warrant. I need to arrest the suspect, you know, collect the evidences, analyze the evidences that indeed it's this person who was behind the computer, and the computer is connected to the internet, and the computer had the following IP address at the time of the incident. Perform a bit to bit copy, so it's a read only, meaning that, you know, we just scrap everything from the hard drive. And then we put it as an image, like on Linux it can be DD image or ISO image or what kind of things we use. And then the police needs to identify the abuse images. So at some point, they've been built hypothesis that needs to be rejected. In the end, the person was jailed for 9 months. But the hypothesis that drives the investigation, as I mentioned, it's something that is based on the all possible factors that we can consider. Like, for example, there has not been any sharing from this IP, and the law enforcement just had a mistake or error in the IP address. The suspect has an open wireless network, so anyone could join, you know, possibly to this Wi-Fi and do this illegal activity. The suspect was in possession of illegal images, but shared by accident, meaning that he wanted to share only something that was legal. The fourth hypothesis is the suspect has shared the illegal images. The fifth suspect has taken part in the production, ordering, streaming, the sexual abuse from a perpetrator abroad. The suspect has committed the child abuse himself and shared the images. The suspect has access to many children. And then the last one is suspect is a part of the organized network with the criminal activities. So you can see, starting from the first hypothesis to the last hypothesis, how the, let's say, perception of the crime changes from being completely innocent to being completely guilty in this particular crime. And the point is to confirm this hypothesis or to refute based on the data that were collected during the investigation. And it's very, very important to use a proper scientific methodology, you know, chain of custody, order of volatility when analyzing the data from the computer, because, you know, one changed timestamp in the file can, you know, move from hypothesis 1 to hypothesis 8, depending, you know, on the perception and evidences. So it's very important to preserve, you know, the evidences and the data. I think we can take a short break. Let's see. We can come back at 15. So 10 minutes to refill the coffee, and then we start with the second part of the lecture. Any questions about the tasks, like the group work, papers, projects? All right. Right, welcome back. So it's something that is, you know, the core concept in forensic science and digital forensics is the timeline. Especially, it's crucial to digital forensics when we need to understand like what happened. Because, like, if you look at the normal digital forensics training, if you have, for example, a group of people, they divide it in two. One group of people is trying to prove that, you know, the person was guilty based on the information from the hard drive. Another group is trying to prove that the person is not innocent based on the data from the hard drive. And it's very interesting because, you know, depending on skills and depending on things that people find on the hard drive, it might be that, you know, one time one group will prove that the person is innocent, another time another group will prove that the person is guilty. So it all depends on, you know, timeline and things that you can put together. When it comes to, you know, to changes in the files and changes in the system, we're talking about the evidence dynamics. And, you know, all things around us are very dynamic. So even on the computer, if you look at the RAM, you know, it takes microseconds, milliseconds to change things in the RAM. Things on in the backup, you know, it will take, I don't know, a year to change everything in the backup storage because the backup are rarely, not rarely, they're less often stored than, for example, things that are in the RAM. So it means that we'll have a different timeline. So during the investigation, we'll need to understand like how things changed, what kind of changes have been done, when the time passed, you know, how these changes affected the overall picture, the data. Because one thing, if you have a big hard drive, another thing, if you have a small hard drive, and then, like, the user didn't store all of the data. So it means that we cannot have access to everything that we could possibly have. So normally it's recognized four types of the cyber crimes. ICT as a target. So let's say an organization is trying to attack another organization. So it means that, you know, the whole ICT of the organization will be considered as a target. Now, ICT as a tool, a hacker is trying to break into organization, so the laptop of the hacker will be used as a tool to break in into this particular organization. ICT is affiliated with the crime, meaning that the ICT technology wasn't directly involved, but for example, a CCTV camera, for example, access logs to the room can be considered as, you know, source of relevant evidences. Crimes against ICT industry, so all, you know, these kind of big cases when, you know, the hackers try to break into the, you know, DNS provider, so they try to, for example, compromise the supply chains. This is the crime against the whole industry. The Cybercrime Convention that I mentioned in the beginning, it's one of the fundamental conventions on the cybercrime. I also mentioned that it's from 2001 and then ratified 2016 by 52 countries. It's old, so it means that it doesn't cover things like IoT, no smart application, drones, and so on. So there weren't all these things back in 2001. So the digital forensics, it's an umbrella term again. So as a forensic science, you know, includes multiple pillars and multiple domain, the digital forensics or the computer forensics includes multiple subdomains and subfields as well. Like, for example, malware analysis, network forensics, social network mining, content identification, database forensics, and so on. So technically, you know, what people do, they just take terminology from the computer science and add forensics, you know, mouse forensics. I'm joking. But technically, you know, it's all like Android, Windows, Linux forensics, so everything related to that specific technology. Now, when it comes to the process, there are usually two two stages, distinct stages, something that happens on the crime scene or so-called field work. So this is identification, preparation, approach, strategy, and preservation of the data carriers. When the police officers arrive, they need to find like what are the relevant evidences, sources of evidences, like the digital carriers, devices, how they connected, are there any other hidden devices in the room, for example, and how to store them, because some of the devices might be on, some of the devices might be off, like as the picture I showed in the beginning of the lecture, you know, you will have a different decision tree for each specific case. And then it's about the lab work, so collection, examination, analysis, and preservation. When the data carriers, like computers, devices, they arrive in the police station, there is usually a lab, a laboratory that works with the devices, like, you know, in Kripos, Ökokrim, they have own labs with a lot of equipment to approach different cases. So one case might be that you get Android phone with Android possibly version 4. SD card, the SD card is not encrypted, there are a lot of data, so it's relatively easy. Another thing, if you get a Nokia phone from 99, you don't even have the connector for this phone. So it means that they need to have a huge toolkit, you know, to analyze and extract the evidences. Something that I showed before, you know, it's all types of operations that you can imagine, from simply connecting things to the computer to breaking the phone when you need to break in and you know access the data on the phone. Of course, there might be a protection mechanism, you know, that will not allow usage of the Cellebrite devices. Sometimes you can also have you know the data extracted from the SIM cards using the readers like this on the left side, because you know if you take a SIM card. Normally, it's SMS, the contacts, so some additional information that you can extract, and it may contain very, very important information. And digital forensics, as I mentioned, it's all types of, you know, technologies in the computer domain. You just take the terminology and add forensics to it, and technically, the industry itself is huge because so many companies focusing, for example, on just Windows forensics or just macOS forensics or just Android forensics. And they built, you know, not just software tools, but they also built hardware tools. They design trainings, they design certifications. So the area is huge. I will upload this document to Blackboard. But this is the guidelines that have been published last year from the Interpol, how to approach the crime scene by first responders on the crime scene. And you'll see, you know, all different novel technologies and how to use them and what to select and, you know, what to use in each particular case. And so have a look at this document, but also keep in mind, you know, the Cybercrime Convention, that you will see this kind of tremendous gap, the technologies explained in the Cybercrime Convention and the technologies explained, for example, in this document published by Interpol. There are a lot of innovations, like some of you wrote in Mentimeter, OSINT, open source intelligence. You know, it depends on the case, of course. Like social network analysis is one of the easiest because, you know, people used to put a lot of information openly on the social media, and this information can be misused. This information can be used by the police because, you know, if the profile is open, if the, you know, posts, everything is open, then it's considered to be a public information. So you've seen probably cases when people, you know, make selfies with a bag of money because they sold something, and the next day they got robbed because they had, you know, the geotag and all subsequent information available on Facebook. Internet of Things forensics, something that I mentioned today. Open source intelligence and digital forensics intelligence, it's new areas that are used a lot by companies because it's actually a business model. When you want to investigate something and you want to gather information, there are a lot of bits and pieces out there openly. So you don't really need to break the system. You just need to collect and synchronize and aggregate all the information. Smart grid forensics, smart card forensics, and application of artificial intelligence and deep learning. So normally when we talk about software, digital forensic software and the tools, the functionality, or rather intelligent functionality that you'll find is usually either a keyword search, meaning that you want to, you know, look for the word bomb, for example, through the hard drive. And then, you know, you enter this keyword in the search field and you'll get the results of all the files. So you don't need to look yourself. It also can be e-discovery. When, you know, using the tool, you can explore, you know, all the file system, all the files that you have there, maybe have some linkage and so on. But now we also see the application of artificial intelligence. Like, for example, you know, using the Cellebrite, sometimes autopsy, you can get, for example, the objects from the picture. So you can get, you know, automated classification of the pictures, you know, buildings, animals, people. One thing. Another thing is the tool can analyze the picture and say that, okay, so we have one picture in this folder, but we also found maybe, you know, two or three more that are very similar to this. So the tool give you this information. So it becomes, you know, more and more artificial intelligence friendly and deep learning friendly, analysis of the text, analysis of the traces, correlation, and other things. And it's data driven. So as I mentioned, the digital forensics relies on the data, on the digital data. And when we talk about all the subphases in the field work, in the lab work, you will see, you know, that it's so many different types of, you know, small kind of operations that you can perform on each type substage, like, you know, list of digital carriers, logging of events, and so on. So it's a lot of data that been aggregated together. And actually, what happens that sometimes, you know, the data became so large that the police has to discard all the data because it's too much. They don't have capacity or reasonable, you know, resources to keep all the data. But from this picture, you can see that we have so many ways, you know, to analyze and to use the data and correlation in the digital forensics process. So we talked about, you know, the general approach and how we, you know, perform steps in the digital forensics, but also what we need to understand that, you know, it's all about how we analyze the information, how we assess the information, whether it's, you know, it's there is a level of trustworthiness to the information, if it's, you know, good or not, or if it's relevant or not, if it's erroneous or not. So it's a lot of if questions. Like, for example, you know, they can be coded SMS. Like, if you look at the SMS, it may look like a normal SMS, maybe a bit strange text, but then in matter of fact, there might be some kind of coding. The GPS routing, there might be some issues with the GPS and how the GPS has been recognized. There might be also traces that the person looked for the particular ways to commit the crime, which was found in the logs of the Firefox, of the Chrome. And also it can be that, you know, the system is so complex that it's extremely difficult to correlate, you know, all possible data points, like in the automobile computers. In this course, you also hear about the crime and incidents. So the crime is the police investigation. So something happens, like, for example, a murder. And then there will be a specific set of laws applicable to that particular, you know, set of crimes. The incident is rather civilian settings, like, for example, breach of corporate policy. If there is an incident, again, you know, it can be that there was a mistake in the configuration. There can be negligence. There can be malicious intent in the organization. And then, you know, something happens, like data being exposed, data deleted, some corporate secrets stolen. But then it does not necessarily mean that it's a crime. It's just, you know, an incident. It's like characterized as an incident in the organization. And then there is an IT responsibility, whether they have, for example, CISO, they have incident response team, how they handle it. And of course, not all of the incidents are reported to the police as a crime. But as you know, according to GDPR, you know, all things related to breach of data, when you know the personal identifiable information was breached and exposed, there has to be a notice period. So the company needs to fill in the notice that you know there was some issue. So it's just one of the examples when you know it's kind of obliged by law, otherwise they will get fined. But again, you know, it's the incident in the first place that, you know, something happened, not necessarily criminal. And also the focus of the actions around the crime, very different from the actions around incidents. Like for the crime, the idea is to secure the convention for the society. We need to preserve the evidence by means of read-only write blockers. So it means that if we copy all the information from the hard drive, there won't be any bytes or bits changed on the original source. For the incident, it's the way to manage the risk. So it's rather on the IT governance side, you know, the enterprise risk management, how we make sure that this won't happen again. And then we also need to restore the business continuity. So it means that the company needs to run. Of course, there will be some kind of assessment, you know, how did this happen, how we can prevent. If it's an easy fix, we fix it, and then we continue. So don't really need to, you know, to report to the police, because if the police is involved, then we need to, you know, cease the operation and deliver all the data from the hard drives to the police, because they need to analyze it. So usually the goals of the of the incident response and the digital forensics are very kind of different. There will be also a guest lecture about, you know, incident response certifications, like how to, what kind of certification you can take, you know, what kind of training you can take for the incident response for the digital forensics. So, of course, as I mentioned, you know, it's a conflict or the trade-off between one thing or another one. Like if it's private enterprise operations, the idea is to, you know, to restore the operations and continue with these operations. If it's a law enforcement, the idea is to preserve everything that could be possibly relevant to the crime, and then investigate this crime as much, you know, if it takes a lot of resources and time. And of course, it can be also linked to the SORTS and National Security Intelligence Services to exchange the information and, you know, to kind of like notify if something happens. So most of the forensics is after the fact. So when something happens, you know, we need to understand what happened prior to the incident, you know, T-minus 10 days, T-minus 5 days, and, you know, analyze the log files, analyze the files, maybe, you know, dig through backup and find all the data that is relevant for this particular case. It also can be, let's say, active approach when, you know, if there is an intrusion going on, then, you know, we need to stop it somehow, we need to respond to it. So often it's about the digital forensics readiness, so how much readiness we can integrate in the organization. Because when we talk about readiness, it's usually about the budget. Because, you know, having the readiness, we need to have probably better solutions. We need to store more data. We need to hire additional people to monitor the network and establish SOC center, and so on. The digital forensics digital forensics is about a multiple level of abstraction. So when you take the hard drive, it's not just, you know, you have Microsoft files there, right? So you have a certain nested level of abstraction. We'll also talk about this in a few lectures time. But normally we talk about media. So this is binary representation of the data. Then it's a device, a physical object that stores the data. It can be micro SD, it can be, you know, hard drive, spindle hard drive, it can be SSD, and so on. And then the device can contain, you know, media. So moving from the abstraction of bytes, the next abstraction will be, for example, you know, the partitions and the volumes when we assemble the bytes into the files. And after that, we analyze the file and then make a conclusion that some files are relevant, some files are not relevant. So while doing this, all this, let's say, approach and scientific methods that we're using in the digital forensics, they need to be, they need to follow, let's say, the forensic soundness in a way that we need to make sure that, you know, our approach is repeatable, it's technically sound. If there are any errors, we need to know what kind of errors, you know, what kind of things we've done through the analysis of the data. And then based on the methodology that we are using, we're also formulating the hypothesis, right? So we need to test the hypothesis. So the example that I gave with the request to UK police and 8 hypotheses, this is how it's done. So we need to test each hypothesis and either, you know, reject or accept each of those. So it's often about also, you know, the processes and the policies and the laws, because what if crime happens in one country, but it's been aided or orchestrated from another country? In this case, we're talking about the cross jurisdiction, so meaning that it's one jurisdiction, but you cannot really, you know, go to another country and seize all the data from some kind of server. So no, there has to be a certain procedure to follow. So normally it's the request, the police request. In case if international police cooperation framework is in place, it's easier. If there is no cooperation between the countries, then, you know, like it's very difficult to get the information. Like, for example, if US sends a request to, I don't know, Belarus, you know, please give the information about this particular IP address and the person who was behind the address, there is a chance that you they won't get any response, and vice versa. So it depends on many factors, you know, the political, geopolitical situation and the relationship between the countries and, you know, the kind of participation of the country in all these international networks. So the two fundamental principles in the forensics, in the digital forensics, the evidence integrity. So the evidence needs to be preserved in the original form. And what it means in the digital forensics is that if we come to a crime scene and we see a computer, and then maybe 10 days later we analyze the files on the computer, it needs to be the same file without any changes. So we need to preserve the integrity of the file. And you will see later in this course that it's usually done or validated through hash sums, like MD5, for example, is a very simple tool. Of course, there have been attacks against MD5, but still, for the purpose of integrity validation, it's sometimes used in the tools. The chain of custody, this is a complete set of, you know, information that, or meta information that follows the analysis of the data, collection of the evidences, presentation of the data. Actually, in tools like Cellebrite, Autopsy, there will be laboratory information management system that helps to put, you know, all necessary information, like what's the name of the person who analyzed the data, when, what kind of files you want to include in the final report, are there any interesting artifacts found, and so on. So the data, so in overall, when we talk about the, you know, the hypothesis, we need to find the data that will support this hypothesis, or refute the hypothesis, or reject the hypothesis that, you know, it's not relevant because of this. And often the problem, as I mentioned, is the these abstraction layers, whether we can, you know, reconstruct the hard drive. Like, for example, if we are talking about things related to, you know, broken hard drive or broken memory stick or any types of, you know, damaged devices, we may get access to the physical media. So it means that we may get the access to the platter of the disk. But then can we really read it? So we probably need to have a corresponding hard drive, you know, to change the platters. It's one thing. Another thing, what if it's encrypted? We can't really, you know, access the data. If it's encrypted, we don't have the key. If it's not encrypted, what if part of the platter is damaged? So then, you know, we might get only pieces of the data. Of course, we can use the, you know, things like file carving and, you know, similar to recreate, kind of. You learn about this in the course, like, for example, a tool in Linux called TestDisk is a fantastic tool. You can technically recreate, restore a lot of information just using this open source tool. So the metadata, it's not the data itself, but the data about the data. And what it means is that so many pieces of information around the file. Like, for example, it can be the time of the creation, you know, time of the modification, who owned the file, like user ID, group ID, where the file is placed, if we can find, you know, the information about the file in some of the log files, and so on. The same applies for images. Like, EXIF data is just a treasure, you know, like if you have all the data stored in the image, like geotags, you know, all information about the camera, possibly owner, it's a treasure. And of course, there have been more and more challenges, like, for example, errors, uncertainty, and all type of, you know, kind of things that you will see, because sometimes, you know, the tools will create errors. So sometimes if you look for two words in the keyword search, the tool will say that there are no such information, because this is the way how the tool works, and maybe the logic, you know, internal logic of the full text search, that it does not use, you know, the moving window or something like this. But it doesn't mean that there is no file with the particular keyword in the system. So it means that there is a kind of error. And we need to know these aspects. So often you will find articles or, you know, description of the tools that this tool may not work if you're looking for, you know, more than three words, something like this. So it's very, very important to know about such implications and things that, you know, you may miss because of the tool malfunction or because of the logic of the tool. Also, as I mentioned, that timestamps is a big thing. We need to ensure that, you know, we have all the timestamps, reliable time zone. There is no changes in the time in the file. And there is no also kind of alteration. Meanwhile, you know, the computer is on. When it comes to geographical location, it's actually a very, very interesting case when the GPS shows that you're in the Null Island. So the Null Island, how many of you know about Null Island? So it's located around here, and it's not a physical island. It's called Null Island because some of the developers of the apps, like for Android or for other mobile applications, they put 00 instead of null when the device cannot get the GPS signal. And there are two differences. So null usually means that, you know, you cannot get the data, or there is an error, or there is something. So it's a status of the system. While 00 means that, you know, we get the data, and the position is 00. So sometimes what happens is that we get this null island instead of null, just because there was a mistake, or let's say the software developers, they didn't follow the best practices. And in overall, the digital forensics process, you will see, you know, all the things that I mentioned today attributed to the digital forensics process, like, for example, timeline analysis. You know, it will be in the part of analysis and presentation. File carving, you know, it will be on the level of collection, examination of the things that you can extract from the device. There are cases, you know, when at first we think that, you know, it's not possible to crack this case, but then because of the police cooperation, because of the open source intelligence, because of the tremendous work on digital data analysis and other things, it's actually quite possible to crack the cases, like Silk Road. It's another example. This particular spy eye, how many of you heard about the spy eye? It was a banking Trojan that was collecting all type of the information, you know, from the system, from the browser, like afterfilled credit card details, you know, email addresses, passwords, and so on. So there were creators behind, so at least two people were behind, let's say, this kind of initiative to create the spy eye. They also think that the origin comes from the Zeus malware or botnet. But the goal here was to, let's say, to extract monetary revenue. So the direct goal was to get money as much as possible using, you know, stolen credit card details, and then also the scheme that involved mules, that people were kind of, you know, a link while doing the money laundering. And it was quite organized. There were a lot of people involved, you know, multiple systems. Programmers, there were posts on the dark web. For example, you can buy, you know, for $500 a piece of malware. So it became a crime as a service, technically. And then at some point, you know, there were 50 millions of computers infected worldwide. So there was Safari, there was Firefox that were kind of targeted, and quite many bank accounts compromised. So it's estimated that $1 billion lost by institutions and individuals. And one of the hackers' client reported he made $3.2 million in 6 months. So there was a business where people were selling access to them, to the computers. It became a very complex and big international case across multiple countries. They've been trying to, you know, to locate people. They've been trying to analyze, you know, all types of traces, all types of binaries that were found on the victims' computers. The IP addresses where the access was provided from. And actually, in the end of the investigation, one of the people behind this malware was convicted for, I think, 9 years, and another person was convicted for 24 years in prison, just because of this international cooperation, you know, tremendous work, evidence collection, aggregation, and linkage. So it's just an example how complex these investigations can be. All right, so that's the short introduction or overview of the course. Let's say the first chapter is Introduction to Digital Forensics. We'll talk more about different technologies. We'll talk more about the tools. You will learn, you know, all these tools during the lab session. So if you have any questions, it's time for questions. Anyone? So if no questions, you can always shoot me an email and I will try to respond. But thank you for attending today and for listening. I'll see you next week then.